G'day, world. You're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network, episode 334, as I should say, because I'm in France recording this. What's 334 in French, Sean?
334.
There you go. You heard it. I'm recording this on my last night in Corsica, in Ajaccio, with my new friend, Alon Klebanov. Welcome to the show, Alon.
Thank you so much.
Why don't you...
What an honor.
Why don't you identify yourself?
Ooh, that's tough. Well, not that tough. I'm Israeli, man of the world, trying to be anyway. I'm a historian. I'm a lecturer. I love art. I love music. Trying to strive for perfection, and as such, being highly influenced by all sorts of individuals like the one we are going to discuss tonight.
More than once over the course of the last week, I've heard Alon be referred to as a Renaissance man, mostly by himself, but that's another story. I'm kidding. Now, at this conference we've been at, the Napoleonic Congress, Alon's presentation was on art and like tall ships in art.
Now, it was called Fighting Temeraire and Her Companions, and it was the reflection of the naval scene during the 18th century, mainly during the Napoleonic Wars, in the art of the contemporary art.
And it was fantastic, and I would love to get him to do it here, but it doesn't make sense without being able to see the paintings themselves, which Alon describes in his talk. So I said, he's a man with varied interests, as am I, as you all know. And I said to him, so what do you want to talk about? What's your number one passion? He's a man of many passions. And he said, Bach. Did I pronounce that right?
Absolutely.
Bach. So, you know, I've listened to a bit of Bach. I love myself a good Bach cello suite and some other stuff. But a lot. We were talking in a bus down to, where were we going today? Elba?
We were in Elba. We flew to Elba and had a tour of the island.
This week is sort of all merged into one big long day. But Alon was talking about the very great genius. As far as you're concerned, probably one of the greatest.
The only thing between Shakespeare and God for me.
Okay. So why don't you tell us a little bit about J.S. Bach, and let's try and capture why you were so passionate about him and what you believe his contribution to the human race was.
Let me start with a personal story. It was during what we call in Israel sixth grade. I was about 15 and a half, 16 at the time. My parents went abroad, and I was in Israel, believe it or not, preparing for my first quiz, television quiz. I became a bit of a celebrity because I did a lot of quizzes, won all sorts of prizes, etc., which were in the time like two books, and now I would have been a millionaire, but it was back in the 70s, so I got two books. And I was, while I was preparing for this quiz, I just went through my dad's record collection, and I listened to this and to that, and I was already musically oriented. I played the piano, but I listened to what I don't listen to anymore now, like rock and roll and like jazz and all sorts of things. And I reached at some stage a record which I had heard before, but okay, but then I was in a mood to sit and read and prepare in order not to completely fuck up the quiz show. So I listened to it. It happened to be the Brandenburg Concertos, which, by the way, blew John Lennon away when he heard it for the first time. But that's another story. Maybe we'll come back to it later. And I heard it. And then I don't know why, because I was all set to this TV quiz show, and I suddenly realized I'm not listening to anything else. I just played it again and again and again and again and again. And it was, believe it or not, a revelation. I suddenly realized that I thought to myself, wow, you know, I'm musically educated and this and that. Well, I was a kid. I was 15 and a half, 16. Suddenly, for me, it was like the clouds suddenly spread, and I saw myself on a hilltop looking at the Olympus, looking at the Everest. if you wish. The TV quiz is long ancient history, but from that moment, it was, I have had, for me, if I look back on my childhood, all right, I've had my first girlfriend, I had my first sexual experience, I went to the army, I did this, I did that. If I look at the point where I was transformed from childhood to maturity, it was then. And it was through the help, through the assistance, through the ladder presented for me from heavens by this Johann Sebastian Bach.
Let's stop and listen to a little bit of the Brandenburg.
Number six.
Oh, you didn't say that before. I don't know which one I've got here.
Because I listened to all six of them, one after the other.
Well, hold on, let's see what this one is. See if you like this. So you didn't like that?
I hated this. The person who did that ought to be hung, drawn, and quartered, preferably with rusty old knife. I'll do it myself, starting with an organ which comes in pairs. Never mind.
Okay, so you said before that it took you from child to man when you heard the Brandenburg Concertos. Why? How? It sounds all very nice and romantic.
No. I'll tell you why. Because the abstraction level required in order to fully understand Bach is a real blessing. Many people enjoy music, which is great. But music is... Some people... You know, earlier on we had an argument with a person whom I greatly love. But he is more limited in his attitude, because he believes, and I mean it is nothing, I mean it really it says nothing about him as a human being. He's the finest human being, but but he has not been blessed with this gift. Music is spiritual food. Music is no entertainment. Music is not there to listen to while driving or eating or having sex. You can do everything and enjoy it, and it's fine. But music is there to uplift you.
That's a very elitist position.
Yes, it is. But so is Shakespeare, if you wish. So is Rembrandt. So is James Joyce. So is... Look, art elitism is the... for me, is not a derogatory term. It's the effort you make. It's an effort. It's something... And I'm saying, look, I come as a lecturer. I am a strong believer in the need to share. Now, no, I'm no missionary. I hate missionaryism because I don't claim any soul, any single path to heaven. No way. But I believe that great things are there to be shared. And if this show persuades one person to listen to Bach, not while doing 100 million other things, but closing his eyes, fully concentrating and trying to realize what this simple, almost peasant-like country teacher is trying to tell him, bridging these 250 years, then this effort is worthwhile.
So where should people start with Bach? If people are new to Bach, where should they go?
A very good question. A great question. But if you like, I would preferably come back to it a little bit later.
Okay.
All right. I will remember it too, because I would like the audience maybe just a little bit further about who the man was and what are the circumstances and why is he considered by the experts. I mean, this show, maybe some experts are listening to it now, maybe some laymen are listening to it now, and it's fine. But I wish to maybe a little bit give the situation or the groundwork, and then we'll return to this very good question later. Bach was born in 1685, a year which incidentally saw the birth of two other giants of the late Baroque period, Handel and Scarlatti, Georg Friedrich Handel and Domenico Scarlatti. This is late Baroque. Baroque is a period which comes after the Renaissance. When we discuss the history of art, and music is a part of it, we see that when Europe, when the world starts to change its outlook upon things in the end of the Middle Ages, what is known as the Middle Ages, then there is a great revival of ideas known as the Renaissance. Renaissance comes from, basically the original term is in Italian, Rinascimento dell'Antichità, the rebirth of antiquity. And the rebirth of antiquity doesn't mean that in antiquity they painted like Botticelli or Leonardo, but the ideas of humanism. Humanism comes from the word homo. Homo in Greek and then Latin means men, like homo sapiens, thinking man, etc. And the word humanism means that man is in the center and not God is in the center. And humanistic ideas are the basis of the art of the Renaissance. Music in the Renaissance underwent amazing changes in different aspects, which is not really the subject of this show, but it developed greatly. But the music and the art of the Renaissance were very rational, were very much based upon thought, upon the brains, upon the educational, the rational attitude towards things. And at some stage, people said, hey, where's the emotion? You know, this is all great, this is very rational, this is so clever, but we want some emotion. And I'm simplifying it naturally, but the Baroque is basically changing from the mind or the brains being the central thing, the heart.
Okay, we just stopped there for a minute while my phone rang and I had to take a call, but we're back.
Yeah, so what happens is the Baroque, which is very emotional, which means that...
What does Baroque mean?
Baroque comes from a Portuguese word, and it means... To start with, it starts as a derogatory term, like the Impressionists being its first derogatory term, or the Fauve, or other terms in history. It means something which is wrong, which is distorted, which is not straight, not right. It's the name of a secondary type of pearl, and if the pearl is not perfect, then it's Barocco, then it's basically bad, second rate. But the term is simply being used more and more as to signify the difference from the previous style. And the Baroque composers placed an immense emphasis upon emotion and upon now not instead of trying to outdo each other in the most supreme and the most perfect harmony to express emotion and to express feeling. And the most important genre, which is born and signifies the transition from Renaissance to Baroque, is opera. Opera appears around 1600. The first opera which reaches us in complete form is from 1607. It's Claudio Monteverdi, L'Orfeo, Favola e Musica. And from that moment on, we are in the Baroque. Incidentally, the same thing exactly happens in art, happens in visual art, when people do away gradually with perspective and fantastic infrastructure of a painting, and they start dealing with emotion. You know, when a Roman rich patron asks Caravaggio, the painter who is the person of the transition from Renaissance to Baroque in visual art, he says, would you like to come and paint my collection of antiquities to learn how, you know, Renaissance, etc.? And he says, no, thank you. I'd rather use the vagabonds and the beggars on the street. They will be my models. And so it's something else. So that's a great comparison. Anyway, Baroque starts in the beginning of the 17th century. So the first generation of Baroque composers, Monteverdi was born in 1567, and second generation, what is called early Baroque, 1567 onwards. Then what is called high Baroque or middle Baroque period, the composers who have already matured or grew up in the musical environment, which was already influenced by the great predecessors of the early Baroque period. So they wrote for individualistic performances. When I'm saying individualistic, I'm sure that even the less musically educated of you, dear audience, you know the meaning of the word aria. Aria means the expression of the emotions of the individual. When a person says, "Oh, I love you so much," and he sings, so that's an aria. An individual sings. Aria is always for one person. It's a singer. It can be a male singer, it can be a female singer, but it's the expression of the emotions of the individual. And the opera really enhances it. Opera is all about emotion, about love, about hate, about passion, about jealousy. And so the opera is the quintessential Baroque piece of music. And that's, again, the second generation appears, and we gradually see how the Baroque is broken. It splits into different traditions. So we have Italian Baroque, we have French Baroque, we have English Baroque, we have German Baroque. And again, in order not to go too much into the different traditions, I would say that the Germans are Germans. Ordnung muss sein, sagt man in Deutsch. Must be order. The Germans are the most orderly people on the face of the earth. They are very organized. Everything has to be well organized. And I mean, for good or for bad. Today, Cameron and myself, we've seen what great organization means. We've been to the island of Elba, which is run by the Italian government, and we're lucky to be back here.
at all.
Yeah, but it was a great circus. But and believe you me, my dear listeners, nowhere on the face of the earth is as great as Italy. But the Italians are the most charming people. But when it comes to organization, they leave something to be desired. However, the Germans are very good, very well organized. They maybe lack the passion of the Italians, but they make do with a trying to do things in an organized manner. For example, I've mentioned Händel. Händel, who grew up in Germany, born in exactly the same year as Bach, felt that something was missing. What does he do? Leave a great career and goes to Italy. And he combines together. Bach does something similar, but we'll talk about it in a minute. Anyway, Bach was born in 1685. Bach, as are Händel and Scarlatti, composes of the late Baroque period. So that's called late Baroque. Late Baroque means that these people, these composers, are now using the traditions, the achievements of their great predecessors already in two generations, and they bring it to perfection. So the late Baroque period is the period where the Baroque really reaches some sort of peak. Some sort of great outburst of creativity before being replaced by another style, which we may come back to in another talk. But what happens is that Bach is being born 1685 to a very musical family. His great-great-great grandfather, Veit Bach or Vitus Bach, moves to the area of Thuringia, today in southeastern Germany, from the area of probably around the Rhine district or something like that, maybe even from Holland. We're not certain, but he owned a water mill, and we know that he was a lute player. So while after the day's work, he would take his lute and sing. He transferred to his descendants the greatest gene pool of musical greatness in history, because the Bach family became, very short time after Veit Bach, either one generation or the other, or the next one down the line, this family started to produce musicians on an amazing scale. And there have been musicians in the Bach family like four generations before Johann Sebastian. One must understand that in the 16th century, the same century that we hear about Veit Bach for the first time, another guy arrives on the scene, very close to where Bach arrived on the scene, 202 years later. That's Martin Luther. Now, Martin Luther, or as it Luther is in English. In German, you say Luther. Luther brings about the Reformation. October 31st, 1517, he hammers to the church door a document which was one of the most revolutionary documents in history. It's called the 95 Theses, and it really tears apart the Christian world. And what Luther does when we refer to music, I mean the musical context, is that he does away with art, with the visual art. For Luther, all these beautiful, magnificent paintings with gold and the frescoes, and this is all pagan. This is all no.
Idolatry.
Exactly. He says this instead of assisting the believer on his way to identify himself or to understand his creator, this takes his mind away. This is wrong. And what he does, he does away with everything. And if you look at a Lutheran church, they're very Spartan, they're very simple. But Luther says that the most important thing, the one form of art, he doesn't, bless you, the one form of art he doesn't do away with is music. For the same reason that music is so important also in Judaism and other religions, another religion which does not believe in images, because it is abstract. And Luther says the abstract form is something which not only does not take the believer's attention away, but helps him in his path to better understanding, or to in his prayer, or whatever. We're not doing theology here now, we're just concentrating on the music. And in the Lutheran regions of Germany from 1555, after the Peace of Augsburg, we have a division. The Peace of Augsburg was an agreement which put an end to the first stage, anyway, of the religious wars, and it meant that the ruler's religion became the religion of the region he ruled. It's in Latin, cuius regio, eius religio. He who rules makes the religion. If you liked it, fine, you could stay. If you didn't like it, you could pack and leave and go to a place where you could worship the style you wanted, the way you wanted. So in the Lutheran regions, there was great need for music, because music became a part of the ritual of church services. And the Bach family have been great suppliers for the various churches around Thuringia and elsewhere, because some of them traveled and some of them became musicians in more distant parts. But in this region of southern Germany, they became great musicians. So Bach had a very good starting point. Not personally so, because he was orphaned from both his parents before he was 10 years old. He moved with his brother, who ruined his brother was terrible. Well, I mean, Bach would never speak badly of his brother, because he, after all, he took him to his house and treated him relatively okay. But his brother was terrible. And his brother wouldn't have the young Bach learn in the evening, so he wouldn't allow him to use candles. But Bach, as a child already, had an immense passion for music, did it in the dark, which ruined his eyesight completely. And he suffered from short eyesight and from problems with his eyes for his entire life. But, okay, he starts, and then from the first moment, maturity, he learns from his brother, he learns from his father before he dies, then from his brother, and lo and behold, a talent of extraordinary proportions is recognized very, very quickly by his peers. The talent was first as a performer, and Bach is considered to this very day the greatest organ player of all times. He was on the organ, he was sensational. For those of you who are not familiar with this amazing instrument, this is an instrument which we know about the origins from around 13th, 14th century. It's an instrument you would find in a church. It's made of pipes, and the sound is produced by wind that is passed through the pipes, and the organs gradually develop. And then there is a great breakthrough, it's called the Werkprinzip, which allows actually the organ to be divided into various consoles or groups of pipes. And immediately the possibilities are enhanced to an extraordinary level. And the player has to play with both his hands and with his legs. So it's also very telling physically. very demanding. And Bach, from day one, just shocks his listeners. Not only that, with his perfect hearing and with his ability, he's great also in tuning organs, fixing them, etc. And he makes himself a name already 15, 16 years of age. He's already sought after as an organ player, as an organ tuner, and what have you. And would you believe he gets his first commission? He is invited to come, to leave, and to get a job in the ripe age of 17 and a half, which is in a place which places so much emphasis upon perfection, like organized Germany, is unheard of. He goes to Weimar in 1703, and that's his first job. He doesn't survive there long because he's got a mouth, my God. Those of you who are familiar with Gordon Ramsay, young Bach was a German Baroque version of Gordon Ramsay, and he gets into trouble with virtually everybody because he doesn't think he's more clever than everybody else. He knows he's more clever than everybody else, which reminds me of somebody, but never mind. And not you, Cameron.
No, I know you.
So don't laugh. Yeah. I would cry for you, but anyway, he lives there. And then he goes around, he goes from city to city. He actually doesn't survive very long anywhere because he's got a huge mouth. He's got a real problem with his superiors. But sometimes people tolerate him because they realize it's a talent of, out of this world proportions. I mean, something like cosmic proportions, really.
You and I were talking the other day too about how the Renaissance was the beginning of the concept of the artistic genius as well, yeah, where we started to appreciate
absolutely
that some people have these gifts, and you know they should be not just tolerated for being strange and different, but appreciated.
Yeah, Renaissance. Bach was in a way not that much of a Renaissance man, because look, the quintessential Renaissance man is Leonardo da Vinci, because Leonardo da Vinci does everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really dabbles with everything, he knows everything, he does everything. Amazing person, and he learns all by himself because he had never received any formal education because he was illegitimate, mm-hmm, and he said saper vedere, learn to see. I mean, everything just by that's a different story. Maybe once we'll discuss Leonardo, another person I greatly appreciate, but Bach goes in depth. Bach is an ocean. We'll come back to it later. But Bach, what Bach does, he's now learning his trade. In 1705, he's in Arnstadt, a small town around Thuringia. And he gets a leave, a vacation from his superiors for 4 weeks. And he walks, he's as rich as a church mouse. I mean, he's paid very little. And he walks 250 miles from Arnstadt to Lübeck. Because in Lübeck, there is a great composer of the high Baroque period. His name was Dietrich Buxtehude. Buxtehude was born in 1637, almost 38 years before Bach. And he was the grand uomo. He was the grand homme. He's the master. Everybody knows, everybody talks about with reverence in that period. And they get on like a house on fire. They meet each other. Bach immediately recognizes. Bach reaches Lübeck. Eventually, Lübeck is a city on the Baltic Sea, rich Hanseatic League city from the late Middle Ages. And Lübeck is rich enough to have a composer like Buxtehude in its service. So Bach goes there and they meet, and what a click. Bach immediately recognizes a great master, which wasn't that difficult because Buxtehude was known to be a great master. But Buxtehude immediately, I mean, as a professional, he immediately realizes here is a genius really impossible to define. The genius, the level of Bach's genius. And they get on very so well that Bach outstays, instead of staying for 4 weeks, he stays for months, which definitely made him extremely popular with his superiors, as we understand. And then Buxtehude gives the young Bach, would you believe, an offer he cannot refuse. This is not Marlon Brando, this is only little me. But he gives him an offer. Why don't you replace me? Bach is 20. books, Tehuda is nearly 60. God Almighty. I mean, you know, this is virtually unheard of. However, there is a little hitch. If you want to take my job, you must marry my daughter, who was not that young, nor was she that thin, nor was she that pretty. And I think Bach broke the world record in long distance really? Marathon. Yeah, he ran, oh my God, he ran for it. You know, I mean, he went to Arnstadt like one third of the time it took him to, because he was running all the way, looking over his shoulder, making sure this girl wasn't running after him. But anyway, he, of course, declined the offer. He wouldn't. He was a very passionate man, and he wouldn't marry someone like that just to get the job, which maybe was a strategical error. Had he taken this job, his life would be completely different. But anyway, he learned a lot from Buxtehude. He arrives back. Of course, he falls out with his superiors, who catch him in the organ loft with a girl. In corpus delicti, some people say. But what do you want from me? First of all, she's my niece. Second thing, I'm going to marry her. Third thing is none of your fucking business. It's not German. This is English, but that's about what he said, which you can... By the way, all three are correct. It was his niece. He was about to marry her, and it was none of their fucking business. But that was the end of his career. What a surprise. And back he goes to Weimar. And now, after all these experiences of young age, now this Weimar, he goes back to a wonderful city called Weimar. Weimar is Kleine Athene, is little Athens. Weimar is one of the most cultural places in the Germany of the time. Stop for a second. Germany. What is Germany? Today, of course, what is Germany? Open an atlas, see what's Germany. Who knows what? Germany is a country, you know? No. At the time, Germany is subdivided into hundreds and hundreds of little princedoms, kingdoms, free cities, archbishoprics, what have you. I mean, like little, it was so fractured and so fragmentary. You couldn't believe it. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of these little operetta-like political entities. It was just impossible. Heinrich Heine, the great 19th century poet, joked about this period and said that a person couldn't go out on a rainy day without coming back with a princedom or a kingdom stuck to the sole of his shoe. It was quite hilarious. And these little places... But it was very good for music, because each one of these little courts, operetta courts, wanted to outshine each other by having an orchestra, by trying to show how cultural and educated it was. Very similar to what happened with the Italian cities of the Renaissance, when there was no political unification, and this fragmentary political situation enhanced the creativity in each and every city. Mm-hmm. So the same thing happens in the then... Germany was a geographical term, was not a political term, really. Mm-hmm. And Bach goes to Weimar, ruled by dukes, but there he gets access. First of all, he's much more mature. To remind you, he went to Weimar in 1703 and did not survive there very long. He fell out with his superiors in no time. But in 1708, he goes back there. And now he's more mature. Now he's married, and children start coming one after the other. He was a very passionate man. He ended up by having 20 children. And he had now a family to support. And as I said, he was more mature. And now he gets access to one of the finest musical libraries of manuscripts. And he really, for him, it's a great journey, because now he is capable of discovering lots of great things. He has a reputation like you can't believe. There is a famous story, true story. There was a French, one of the greatest organ players of the time, was called Marchand. And he, at the time, the Baroque was all about personal expertise or I would say personal excellence. And they were, in the Baroque, it was very common to have musicians dwelling with one another on their instruments. So it was like a musical duel, each musician trying to outshine the other. Marchand was well known throughout Europe. Bach was known only in this... Bach never left. Okay, he went to Lübeck, but I mean, he was much more parochial, much more local type of musician. And Marchand arrived, and he was sure he's going just to take a walk, or, you know, just step over this you know, who knows who he is, this little player, German Bach, what's his name? And when and Marchand apparently sent his attendant, his friend, whatever, to eavesdrop upon Bach's playing. And apparently when the competition time arrived, there was no Marchand. When he realized he didn't want to be humiliated, and he ran away. He virtually ran away. And all around, it became known that the Bach was the guy that even Marchand, the great, was too afraid to confront on the organ. So so his reputation grew gradually. In Weimar, he starts now really composing some serious stuff. Bach is in Weimar from 1708 to 1717, and he composes a great variety of things, musical works in Weimar. And he composes his first really great church cantata there, a lot of his harpsichord works, and now we are confronted by a completely new Bach, by a mature composer, by a person who is gradually becoming the master of his time. Bach never leaves this area of southeastern Germany of today, around Thuringia. Okay, he went once to Lübeck and came back, but through the manuscripts in the Duke's library, he discovers the Italian music of the time, the French music of the time, the English music of the time, and he relates to it. And he becomes the person who sums up not only the entire Baroque tradition, but the entire musical tradition. Bach encompasses a universe of music. Now, dear listeners, I mean, it's not presumptuous, but I would seriously say that Bach is... Let me put it this way. I graduated a school of music. And again, I share with you something very personal. When I take... I have been privileged to study under fine teachers who taught me how to use the instruments to analyze, let's say, a piece by Mozart or by Schubert or by Beethoven or by whoever. When I do that and I take a piece of music and I analyze it, the more I go into it, the more I understand it. With Bach, it's the other way around. And this is for me, a total mystery. The more I'm trying to, the more I analyze it, the less I understand how on earth did he do it. This is like magic. This is something, he takes the rules of music and like a child playing with clay, he breaks them apart and puts them back together and again and again and with the ease of, I mean, there are no words in the vocabulary to describe what this man does. And I realize it's very difficult to explain to those without musical education, but if Bach is a person who, once you listen, it's not like, you know, a nice song which you can whistle, you can the tune or something, and after the fifth time or tenth time, that's it, you know, you've had enough. Bach is a person in which every bar is the, how do you call it, the Pacific Trench, the Philippine Trench, whatever. It's, okay, and you can say, what is this guy blabbing about? Trust me. You know what? Listen. Later on, we'll come to the great question Cameron has asked me before about what to listen, what should one start to listen to. And we'll come back to it and I'll talk about it. But there we go. We come back to Weimar, and Bach really composes and his reputation grows. And now he is also an immensely versatile composer because he tries everything. And everything he touches. You know, the legend about Midas, the mythological king who was cursed, blessed by Apollo, that everything he touched became gold. Everything Bach touches becomes, I don't know, platinum. He was not the only one. I mean, there are some others who really excelled in everything they did, like Mozart and others. But Bach reaches a high reputation, does wonders, and the dukes, the two dukes, they were brother dukes. It's leave the political story out for a sec. He is recognized. He is no doubt recognized. Recognized does not mean by any way paid well, because employers, I don't think that it ended in the 18th century, this wonderful tradition of employers.
Was he called composer or something at this stage? What's his title?
No, he was the chief composer for the Duke's court.
Court composer?
Court composer, sorry. Yeah,
Composer.
Yeah, of course.
And that wasn't a well-paid job?
Relative, well, not so much.
Right.
Because
what year are we in now?
He was in Weimar from 1708 to 1717. So okay. He's 9 years in Weimar.
So and he's in his late 20s?
He is, yeah.
He's court composer in his late 20s.
Court composer, yeah. Oh yes, I mean, he did well.
Yeah.
But
not paid well.
Not paid well, no. I mean, you would find that very few artists of the time, of whatever genre, were paid well. I mean, that was the curse of the artist. Still is, to a large extent.
So you've been talking for 40 minutes about his life at this stage, and he's only in his late 20s. You're worse than Markham. You give Markham a run for his money. So let's move on a little bit here. We want to get to the music.
Okay.
Let's get to the music.
He leaves Weimar.
Yep.
Quite bad circumstances. I mean, he gets, because the brothers fight and they give him contradictory instructions, and he follows one set of instructions and he's thrown to jail because of doing exactly that. Long story. More like house arrest than jail, but it was a great insult. Eventually he leaves Weimar. He leaves Weimar, he goes to Köthen, a small place. Cameron is right, I've been going on too long. So I'm going to... He is going to a small place called Köthen for 6 years. Köthen, there's a prince who has just hired some of the best musicians around, and he has an amazing orchestra, and Bach writes, composes there some of his finest instrumental works for the prince, for the court in Köthen. And then he leaves, after 6 years, he falls out with the prince, and he moves to his final destination, the final stop of his life, a city in which he is going to live and compose for 27 years, city of Leipzig. He is in Leipzig from 1723 to 1750, and there he composes a cantata a week, roughly, which is like, dear listeners, composing, writing War and Peace every day, something like that. He writes there the most complex, the most intense music ever written. I want now to give you a term you may not be familiar with, and I'll try to explain. It's called counterpoint. In German, Kontrapunkt. You may be familiar with, you know, each of you must have a song, a tune, he or she, or you, whatever, wherever you are, like, that's great. A tune, a melody, is one of the basic forms in music. You must have a melody, you must have notes one after the other. I wish I had a piano here, but never mind. Notes after the other to make a tune. Harmony is what gives it depth, what gives it a basis, what supports the tune. Counterpoint is a completely different level. Counterpoint is a melody or a tune which is simultaneous with the first one, or the second one, or the third one, or the fourth one, or the fifth one, because Bach would write counterpoint for six themes or six melodies simultaneously, and they would not only not clash with each other, they would come together in a most impossible and unbelievable harmony.
Can you give us an example? What's one of the pieces where we would see this?
I'll give an example. Great question. Bach was invited during his stay in Germany, in Leipzig. Bach was invited by King Frederick II, known as Friedrich der Große, Alte Fritz, Frederick the Great. He was invited to his court in Potsdam. And the king brags about, you know, look, I have this newfangled instrument, it's called the piano. And he invites Bach to try the new instrument. Später, one of Bach's first earliest biographers, recalls the scene. From the moment the old musician from Leipzig placed his fingers on the keyboard, it was clear to everybody present in the room that there was not one king there, but two. The king plays for Bach a tune. Now we are recording it without a musical instrument, so I'll whistle it, and at Cameron's display, he will decide whether to replace my lousy whistling with the proper recording. That's the tune the king plays for Bach. Bach says, very nice tune, Your Majesty. And he sits and he starts improvising. And he improvises a fugue. Now, fugue is the most complex form of counterpoint. And I promise you, I won't go further into that. I don't want to completely confuse you. But he improvises the most complex form of counterpoint with one theme, two, three, four, five, six. Everybody is just about, I mean, they were looking for their lower jaws on the floor.
How can you play six?
Improvise on the spot.
On a piano. You got two hands. How can you play
and
six?
And 10 fingers. If you are Sebastian Bach. If I had a piano, I'd play it to you now.
I'm understanding correctly. That's what you're saying he was doing. He had like six melodies running at the same time.
Based on the same melody.
Yeah.
And receiving contrapuntal, fugal, treatment simultaneously. And he was improvising on the spot.
Wow.
So that's like saying building the Empire State Building from Lego and having it keep for 5 centuries. Unbelievable. Now, he is a humble person, gets into trouble all the time. Lives in Leipzig. His first wife dies. He's married for a second time. Altogether, he fathers 20 children. Lives. I cannot say he didn't live in poverty, but he was never well off. He was okay. Recognized around his musical environment, recognized as a musician, not recognized as an easy person to work with or as a subordinate, as I said, getting into trouble all the time. Handel, who lived simultaneously, was a person received by kings and popes and emperors, not Bach. Bach never left this region, and Bach was, as I said, much more humble, much more simple. And he dies at the age of 65, July 28, 1750. All right, we'll return. What happened with Bach's music will return later. But now we come to Cameron's question. Now, okay, I've listened to that. You say to yourselves, now what shall I go and listen to? Everybody knows, some of you may even use it on your mobile phones. Yeah, now is the time, Cameron. Now is the time to play the Badinerie from the suite number 2. Because this is, first of all, one of Bach's most popular works. And the second reason is that it's very easy to listen to. It's very accessible. Thank you. Now, after listening to the Badinerie, now we hear another thing, that another piece everybody knows. The air, aria. Yes, it's almost sung from Bach's Suite number 3. Thing goes, Pam, I need a fucking piano. Why didn't you bring a piano with? Never mind. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're good.
Ah, we're good. So we've just listened to these two pieces, and they are instrumental. They are easy to listen to. They are accessible, and they are very, very familiar. Everybody knows them. People are using them. Okay. Now, try an experiment. Listen to them again. Rewind your iPods, your cellular phones, your MP3s, whatever you're using. Let's have a little experiment. Close your eyes. Concentrate completely and listen to them again. Listen to them not with your eyes open, looking aside what your wife, your girlfriend does, cursing the driver who just managed to get into your lane. But if you're listening in your car, don't have this experiment right now. But wait until you reach a safe environment. Close your eyes and listen. You'll feel the difference, trust me. Now, let's hear another thing. Let's listen to the Italian concerto. The Italian concerto is a piece for single harpsichord. And Bach, when you listen to it, it sounds as if it is an orchestra. Because with a single instrument, Bach manages to write for so many simultaneous voices, so many simultaneous instruments. It's just amazing. We'll listen to the second movement. You know what? No, sorry. We'll listen to the third movement, which is probably the easiest to understand this phenomenon. Bye. Beatles fans, Brian Epstein recalled an incident in which he, John Lennon listened once to Radio 3. That's the classical channel, the British radio, the classical station in Britain. Still called Radio 3, and it's a great station. And he heard the Brandenburg Concertos. He was mightily impressed, and he asked Brian Epstein to get him the album. And he did. And John Lennon listened to it again, 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 for something like Brian Epstein recalls, I don't remember exactly for how long, but as far as what Brian Epstein claimed, he was particularly impressed with the Brandenburg Concerto number 2. Now we'll listen to the opening movement of the Brandenburg Concerto number 2. Thank you. for years, and he's such a great, fucking great musician. And now, if you wish, look, if it reminds you of Penny Lane, it's not by chance. Because if you Penny Lane is the only... Look, I'm not a Beatles fan. Don't shoot me. I'm not. But from my previous life, I could tell you easily that Penny Lane is the only Beatles song with real counterpoint. With real counterpoint there. Listen to the trumpet in Penny Lane. And you'd realize Bach's influence. The second Brandenburg Concertos, as you've all heard, is scored for trumpets with the orchestra. And so is Penny Lane. And the influence is so clear. Many professional musicians regard, who sometimes analyze Beatles songs or whatever, regard Penny Lane is probably the most advanced or the most complex Beatles song. And it's exactly for that reason. John Lennon was not musically educated. He was very talented. He was not musically educated. And the influence of Penny Lane, the influence of the Brandenburg Concerto on Penny Lane is clearly distinguishable.
But they're
also for the uneducated...
But their producer, George Martin, was a classical producer for decades before he started producing the Beatles. A lot of that sort of stuff came from George Martin.
May well be. You know about the Beatles probably much more than I do, which is not difficult because I know very little about them. But I just know that because of the connection to Bach. Like, okay. This story was recalled by Brian Epstein, and I don't think that...
Let's start to wrap it up. Let's start to talk about what you believe the importance of Bach. For the people listening to the show, why should they listen to Bach?
Now we come to what I would say is the crux of the matter. Okay, we've been through the easy stuff now. Now we're getting down to business. Listen to the following bars. How about that? This is powerful. This is heady stuff. Now we start understanding what Bach is about. Bach has the power to not only throw you off your feet, but to take you to regions which are beyond perception, beyond any ability of any other form of art. We all know this piece. Mm-hmm. But what would you say to that? Warning, before listening to it, make sure your seatbelt's on. Again, close your eyes. Now we have started to fathom Bach's depth. And if you survive that long, you're in there. I'm not going to make it easier on you. So let's continue with something very popular. And think, why is it so popular? Bach writes an amazing tune, which is so simple, yet so profound. And he manages with it to do something that very few people tried, and definitely even fewer succeeded. He writes something which is a prayer. Now, you may be Catholic, you may be Buddhist, you may be Muslim, you may be Jewish, you may be atheist. But this is a prayer of a man who is deeply religious. And religious is not a person who goes and confesses, or a person who goes to synagogue every week, or a person who prays five times a day, or a person who burns incense 13 times a day. This is a man who believes religion is a way to find a dialogue with the Supreme Being, with something above, something higher, something more abstract and more profound than what we can grasp in our daily life. And he does it in a simple way. He doesn't try to prove himself to be very virtuoso or better than anybody else. The greatness in simplicity.
Okay.
Wait.
We've heard lots of music here.
Are we? Oh, we're recording. Yeah. Just one thing, guys and girls. Listen to how what are the instruments doing, and what the choir is doing. Look how simple it is. It's almost nothing. And yet, why is it so divine? Listen, I could sit to the piano, piano harpsichord, I can take the notes, and I can explain the harmonies and the chords and this and that. But the why, the how, is not only beyond me, it's beyond everybody. This is the question. Look, you know, the alchemists in the Middle Ages, they tried to create gold. They tried to achieve immortality. What do you know? This humble organist from Leipzig, he did it. He did it without blowing himself up. He did it without blowing the neighborhood up. Well, he blew the brains of some of his superiors. I mean, they were about to blow his brains if they had a shotgun.
He became immortal? He didn't die?
He didn't die.
No?
No.
He's hiding in Argentina with Elvis and Marilyn?
Exactly. Selling burgers in the local McDonald's. But...
Alon, yeah? Explain to me why Bach is important. Why is Bach more important than Led Zeppelin?
Bach, of course I can go into the simple answer. That Bach is present for 250 years, and time, which is the cruelest judge, is judged him favorably. Bach attracts, Bach connects with the layman, the amateur, the performer, the expert, and the philosopher, all at once. Bach is a philosophy written in music, in notes, instead of in words. The last piece of music which we are going to hear, well, actually, we shall play two or three from this great piece, is his last. It's his musical testament. This is the art of the fugue. Bach takes very simple tune, really nothing. By the way, what we are discussing now is exactly what Cameron spoke with me earlier today about Bach, Gödel, Escher, when the mathematical connections are discussed. And here I come to Bach the mathematician. Einstein said once that his comprehension of science is not deep enough to understand Bach. He wouldn't say it about Led Zeppelin. He would say, let me quote Einstein, what is this shit?
What are we listening to?
First, contrapunt from the Art of the Fugue.
Bye.
Take Musikantico Köln. The same Musikantico Köln, same ensemble.
All right, bring it home for Jesus.
What is there in what have we just heard? Nothing. Bum, 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 ta-dum, dum. Hey, that's all. That's all. Is it really the simplest thing on the face of the earth? Probably. Listen to what it does with it. Hey, jazz lovers, listen to that. Listen to Musikantico Köln. Well, let's go to the second contrapunt, the second piece, if you wish. This is jazz. This is almost improvisation. This is almost jam session. This is, but instead of just acrobatics, look, this note, this simple tune is there. But what's going on here? He develops it. Go open. The Bach, Gödel, Escher. He takes a simple tune, plays it backwards, sideways, forward, back, here, there. What's going on? three things at once, four, five, six, one of them backwards, one of them forward, one of them here, one of them there, simultaneously playing with it, simultaneously treats it fugally, contrapuntually. This is nuclear physics, man. This is the nuclear physics of music.
Alon.
Contrapuntist number two. Second... And we're done.
Okay.
Serious?
Yeah.
3 minutes? Okay.
Wrap it up.
Bach died. And his music, to a large extent, died with him. Because trends change. And new ideas, new sounds, new pieces, new composers. It's the way of the world. He did not entirely die because his music was familiar to teachers, to scholars, who appreciated him, but they were all for the new fashion and the new style and new forms. Until a young... one must say when Mozart discovers him, he's mightily impressed. When Beethoven discovers him, he's mightily impressed. But... exactly 100 years after the first performance of St. Matthew Passion, a young 20-year-old guy from Leipzig, who was in Leipzig at the time, Berlin, Hanover, never mind, Felix Mendelssohn, performs his St. Matthew Passion. And the audience is just beyond himself. I mean, nobody can believe it. Mendelssohn brings back Bach from the sphere of the intellectuals and the academicians to the sphere to the music making and the music loving audience. And he and it just grows stronger and stronger from that moment on. In the early 20th, in the first half of the 20th century, musicians started to revive the tradition of early instruments. That means that instead of playing Bach on the piano, they play Bach on harpsichord. All the performances we've heard, all the recordings we've heard in this program were all authentic, meaning that they were played in 415 pitch instead of 440, which means that they are being performed in the pitch they were composed for, and on the original instruments, which means not a modern symphony orchestra, but much smaller, and not on a piano by a harpsichord, but a harpsichord, etc., etc. And Bach has become one of the, not only one of the most universal composers, but one of the most, I would say, even adopted. I would give an example from a sphere very foreign to me, but I would quote a person nobody doubts his musical capability. Jacques Lussier, a jazz performer, said that Bach is the perfect basis for improvisation because Bach has no limits. He said Bach's music is the most infinite, and I'm quoting him. I mean, you know, I'm not making it up. So he takes it, he regards Bach in a way that I do not necessarily subscribe to, but he relates to the fact that there are no boundaries and no limits to the appeal of Bach. And why is Bach so appealing? Because Bach goes to the beyond. When you listen to Bach, you transcend everything, especially these late works, these contrapuntal great works. This is pure energy. When Arthur C. Clarke writes Odyssey 2001 and Stanley Kubrick directs this amazing movie, what happens? I mean, who are these creatures in the end of the book or the film? These are creatures who managed to transcend the body and became pure energy. These people are, these entities listen to Bach because Bach is sheer spirituality. Bach is the absolute structure which is absolutely abstract. And therefore, this is a construction no aircraft going into would be able ever to bring down. And no earthquake will be able ever to topple. This is the cathedral, which is ephemeral and eternal.
Well, there you have it, folks. I hope you appreciated that. I know it was a long show, lots of music in there for you to listen to. And you might have noticed at the start of the show, I said it was going to be 3:34. I think it ended up being, this will be 3:37 maybe. It's taken me a little bit of time to edit this together and find that not just the specific pieces of music that Alon wanted, but the specific conductors and performers of the pieces of music. He was very specific. Well, I hope you enjoyed that overview. I mean, for some of you, like me, perhaps it's a bit of an introduction to the works of Johann Sebastian Bach. For some of you, perhaps it's a bit of a review if you're not already an appreciator of Bach. And I hope that you've learnt something, and I hope it's made you a better human being. Not sure that Alon really answered my question about why Bach is important or should be important for us, why we should listen to Bach instead of listening to Lou Reed. But he obviously believes it. He's very passionate. It's one of the things that I love about Alon. He's very, very passionate, very articulate. We had a lot of wide-ranging and very interesting discussions during our time in France, and I look forward to getting him back on the show again. He can talk about a million subjects. So this is Cameron out. Until we speak again, do something with your life.